Born on America's darkest day of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been helping America's heroes ever since. When a first responder or military service member doesn't come home and young children are left behind, Tunnel to Towers pays the mortgage on the family home to lift the financial burden. For severely injured veterans and first responders, Tunnel to Towers builds mortgage-free smart homes, enabling severely injured heroes to move around their homes more independently. Through the Foundation's Homeless Veteran Program, Tunnel to Towers is providing housing and services to homeless veterans. More than 3,300 were helped last year alone. Because all veterans who honorably served, whether in peacetime or war, deserve our nation's gratitude. People who put their lives on the line for our country and our communities need your help now more than ever. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good and never forget 9/11 or the sacrifices of this country's heroes. Donate $11 a month at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores. The
stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Buck Brief, diving into national security, the Middle East, Israel, Hamas, Iran, and more with our friend David Ifun on this episode. He is the publisher of the New York Sun. David, always a pleasure. Good to see you.
Likewise, Buck. Thanks for having me.
First, if you would you put into context for us, you know, last weekend, there was this strike of drones and missiles, essentially all just swatted away by Israel and its allies. What was what were your biggest takeaways from that, and how do you think it might affect things going forward?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is just for people to understand that while Iran and its fellow travelers in the region kind of talk a big game, it really is outmatched when it comes to direct combat with the Israelis. As we saw, you know, Israel has multiple tiers of missile defense. So they have, you know, the David sling is kind of the first layer. Then you have the Iron Dome. Then you have the Arrow. Plus you have Patriot missile batteries. Obviously, the participation of quite a few allies in the region, including Arab states, by the way, that are see Iran equally as an adversary in the way that the Israelis do. Iran, on the other hand, has no missile defenses whatsoever, and the Israelis have some quite potent ballistic missiles as well, Jericho missiles, and they could inflict a great deal of damage, which is why, up until now, Iran has taken the approach of working through proxies and has sort of developed what it calls this ring of fire of many proxy states surrounding the Jewish state, with Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon and branches of Hezbollah in the south of Syria. And then, of course, Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza. Obviously, there's reports lately that Iran is also working to destabilize Jordan, which is on another one of the borders. And the Houthis in Yemen have seen missiles flying towards Eilat and towards Israel from the Red Sea angle. So it was unusual, I would say, at least from my end, to see the Iranians enter directly into conflict. Seemed like they were trying to make a point, and I would suspect that they were comfortable doing so because they were confident on the outset that the international community, led by the United States, would really lean on Israel into tempering its response, which, of course, is exactly what we've seen happen in the aftermath.
Do you think that the IDF, do you think that the Iranians knew the IDF would be able to effectively swat away all of the salvo fired, or you know, so basically people have been saying this is what I'm trying to get at with you, David, that this is Iran throwing effectively a lethal tantrum. Yes, an act of war. I mean, not to make it sound like a minor thing, it's not, but that this was for the domestic political optics of, we're not going to just let our brothers in Gaza suffer while doing nothing. So they do this, which doesn't really do anything other than make Iran look like it's pretty militarily impotent. Is that how do you view that assessment? I feel like that was pretty common.
You know, I don't think so. There have been times in the past when Iran has wanted to take that approach specifically, not only vis-a-vis Israel, but regarding the United States. I think their response to the targeted assassination of Qasem Soleimani under the Trump administration was an example. They telegraphed in advance the bases that they were targeting in Erbil in northern Iraq, Kurdish Iraq, and they deliberately missed their target by, you know, a significant margin. So if that was the intention, I don't think they'd have had to throw quite the barrage that they had. I mean, they've done that in the past, and it doesn't look like this. Let's put it that way. When you send sort of 300 projectiles over, including some pretty advanced missiles and different types of missiles in waves, what it looks like to me is as if they're trying to overwhelm Israeli air defenses, which means that their intention was that some of these missiles would get through. And of course, some of them carry massive payloads. So, you know, you only need one or two to land to cause, you know, really significant damage. So I don't think it was their intention just to sort of make a loud noise. I think their intention was that some of these missiles would hit their mark, and it would draw Israel into a broader conflict. And they were surprised, I think, by the potency of Israel's defenses, but also the speed with which Israel was able to mobilize its alliances in the region, which were actually crucial into preventing this barrage. I think without the United States participation and some allies in the region, it would have been hard for Israel to contain this barrage of this extent all on its own.
Can you speak to that, actually? Because the network of alliances that Israel has, I mean, this is a moment where you see who your allies really are, right? I mean, this is when it counts, when you can count on somebody to shoot incoming missiles to your territory down on your behalf or not, right? And I mean, some of the countries that I saw involved in this, for example, the Jordanians, but others, there are other reports that even other regional allies were helping with early warning on this. Like, who was involved in subverting this strike by the Iranians on Israel?
Well, certainly, first and foremost, the United States. But I do believe, you know, intelligence from the Emiratis and the Saudis and others and the Jordanians played a pivotal role. I mean, look, one of the most baffling, well, I don't want to say baffling, but inexcusable positions that the Biden administration has taken has been its approach towards Iran, even more so than its approach towards Russia. It's kind of battling the regime and its initiatives, its meddling in the region, its belligerence in the region with one hand, while also sustaining and fueling it with the other hand. You know, we are fueling the fire and then wondering why the hell it's hot. You know, that's really what's going on here. I mean, the amount of funds that the Biden administration has allowed to flow to the Iranians indirectly, yes, but funds that the regime would not have had access to otherwise. In the end of the day, there are dozens and dozens of actors and allies in the region be very happy to see the Iranians gone and dealt with. I mean, I posted this on Twitter around the time of the strike that ending the regime in Tehran, regime change in Tehran, or ending the Ayatollah regime in Tehran really is a war to end all Mideast wars. I mean, it the effects that it has, it would strangle the occupation in southern Lebanon and in the Syrian Golan. It would obviously boost our allies like the Kurds and others in northern Iraq. You know, most of Iraq is now also controlled by Iranian allies, both on the ground and in politics. It would basically end the civil war in Yemen. It would stabilize Jordan. It would bring safety to the Red Sea shipping lanes, which, of course, is an interest to many in the international community. It would weaken the Taliban, who, of course, are, you know, major human rights violators, and now cultivating, you know, God knows what terror bases and new al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan. The Emiratis, the Saudis, the Moroccans, the Egyptians, the Bahrainis, and most of all, the people of Iran. The people of Iran would all welcome an initiative to remove this regime. I mean, you have millions of people in Iran who would like to see Israel strike Iranian targets, IRGC targets, Islamic regime targets, who they see as their primary enemy. So, you know, if you want to solve the issue, for a long time, we've kind of just been dancing around it, you know, a fight with Hamas, a fight with Hezbollah, a fight with the Houthis, you know, bombing, you know, some of the Houthi capacity in Yemen to free up the shipping lanes, or this or that, or that, or this attack boat or that attack boat. You know, it all comes from Tehran. It all comes from the Islamic regime. You solve that problem and you bring yourself 100 steps closer to peace in the Middle East.
You mentioned Biden and his approach to Iran. I want to dive into that, and also how things stand with Israel and the American Jewish community as well, given all these dynamics. We'll get to that with David Efoun of the New York Sun here in a second. But you might have seen this recently. People are going to big box stores out there and big chain stores, and they're saying, hey, do you have gold? Because they want to buy precious metals. And you should really consider this as well, everyone. Gold, precious metals are a tangible currency, something you can have on hand as a bug out plan. They allow you to diversify your portfolio. They're a hedge against inflation, a store of value. And look, historically, gold increases in value over time. We are in an inflationary environment. Gold is something you can use to balance out your exposure, your risk to the markets and to the currency right now, because gold is solid. It is good. It is tangible. You should call the Oxford Gold Group. That's who I trust. That's who I go to for my gold and silver purchases. Because nobody can predict the future, but we can prepare for it. And that's what the Oxford Gold Group wants you to do. They make owning gold and silver simple and easy to understand. Call the Oxford Gold Group right now. You may qualify for up to $10,000 in free precious metals. 833-995-GOLD. That's 833-995-G-O-L-D. 833-995-GOLD. All right, David, the Biden administration at this point, I mean, the relationship with Netanyahu, can we speak about that for a minute? Because it seems to me like Biden wants to have it both ways. He wants to say, I'm the great ally of Israel, like presidents before me have been, or at least some of them. But also, I'm going to dictate what you can do to defend your own people in a moment of crisis. Like, what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing to keep in mind is that, in truth, every single American president, with the exception of Donald Trump, has tried to meddle in Israel's affairs, not just Israel's affairs, in lots of international affairs, yeah. but in Israel's affairs. I mean, it was George Bush that welcomed and pressured Ariel Sharon to pull out of Gaza in the first place in 2005. I was there when it happened. It was Condoleezza Rice that insisted that Hamas be allowed to run in the 2007 elections that shortly followed in Gaza that brought Hamas to power. So it is a usual par for the course that American administrations meddle in Israel's business. I think the Trump administration genuinely was the only administration that said, listen, you guys know what your interests are, so why don't you tell us what you think needs to be done and we'll be supportive. That was by far the anomaly. Certainly the Democratic administrations have leaned even further, even stronger. And, you know, especially a president like Joe Biden, who at least in my understanding, is not a person that is familiar with the concept of principles. He's a political animal in the very worst connotations of what
absolutely
that means.
Absolutely correct.
Namely, yeah. So, you know, when the world is sort of sympathetic with Israel, so he'll say the right thing. If he sees a political disadvantage in doing so, he'll turn in a heartbeat. You know, he doesn't have any ideals that he sticks to, and that he'll stand by when the going gets tough. And then he's sort of flips back, you know, when the wind changes again. And I think, you know, sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, the thing to understand about the relationship with Netanyahu and the pressure that's being applied on Netanyahu, that both Biden and Chuck Schumer and others in the Democratic Party think they can play this clever game where their opposition policies that executing now that it feels are in its best interest for self-defense can be positioned as an opposition to Netanyahu and his government and his right-wing government and some of the right-wing partners in his government. But the truth is that the policies that the Israeli government is executing right now are policies that are supported by an overwhelming majority of the Israeli public. And it is a national unity government formed together with one of Benjamin Netanyahu's staunchest opponents, which is Benny Gantz. So this idea that it's all about Netanyahu is nonsense. He is executing on what the Israeli people want and need and know is fundamental for their security. And you know, this business of sort of positioning him as crazy and out of lockstep with the interests of the Israeli people is just not in line with the reality, not even close.
Just to understand something that was in the headlines right before October 7th and how everything changed in Israel and in the Middle East over the last, 6-7 months. The court issue with Netanyahu and the Israeli Supreme Court and the Constitution, can you give us a 60-second version of what was going on there? Just because it still sometimes it gets talked about, because the storyline now is Netanyahu was on the ropes, this court issue, the Constitution in Israel, and then October 7th happens and they unite behind him in almost Churchillian fashion. He steps up. You know what? What's the backstory?
What was happening before I would describe as democracy as usual. You've got a contentious issue in the country, namely the power that the Supreme Court has versus other branches of government. It didn't start with Netanyahu. It didn't start with this government. It's been an issue that's festering for ages and ages and ages. In short, the main bullet point is that the judge itself, you know, as opposed to in this country, the administration selects new Supreme Court justices. But in Israel, there is a panel that selects the new Supreme Court justices. And the current Supreme Court justices have the capacity to veto new Supreme Court justices. You know, there's a minimum threshold that needs to be met. So, and they include three of the current Supreme Court justices. So imagine a scenario like this, where the majority of the court is Republican or Democrat or conservative or liberal. And then any new appointment needs to be approved by the majority, right? So you're not going to have, you know, an independent court. It's just going to stay conservative or liberal forever, right? So that's the scenario that they've been dealing with in Israel for a long time. It's basically a permanently liberal Supreme Court. And, you know, that's a normal debate in democracy as to whether, you know, it's too much power and are there changes you're going to make to the power that the Supreme Court has. I mean, there's an argument that you know, over here you have three branches in Israel. You don't have three branches. The legislative and the executive are very much intertwined, so maybe you need a more powerful Supreme Court. But this is part of the negotiation that's happening in democracy. I think the majority of people in the country support some changes. And, you know, the country was in the process of figuring out what those changes are. So, you know, there were bills that were proposed and then there was a lot of pushback. And ultimately, that's how democracy works. If you're going to make laws that people don't agree with, you'll get voted out and the next people will switch them back. So there was a lot of sort of jumping up and down and screaming and shouting. But I don't think it was anything unusual in the sense that, you know, we have these debates in this country all the time. As Winston Churchill famously said, you know, democracy is the worst form of government besides for all the others. It's a messy business, you know, and that's what we were seeing play out in Israel. It's a real democracy, representative democracy, and it's as messy as a good, you know, functioning democracy should be.
I just got to say, if we're speaking about messy democracies and elections, we're going to have to take a look at the U.S. situation here. And I want to ask if you think that the Jewish vote in America in this election cycle, presidential and all the other contests, could swing more toward Republicans than in the past. But first up, one thing we do on this podcast is cut through the noise, the nonsense, ulterior motives, try to uncover the truth that no one else is going to tell you or no one else knows about. And that's what my colleague Mark Chaykin does, but he does it for the U.S. stock market, for investing. Mark worked on Wall Street for 50 years, and across those decades, he invented three new indices for the NASDAQ and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Mark says the majority of Americans are about to miss out on a critical turning point in this AI frenzy. He's calling this a new dawn for U.S. stocks and predicts dozens of specific companies will have major impacts from this in just the next 90 days. Mark has agreed to share one of his favorite AI stocks to buy now with you. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation you can watch for free at 2024AIStock.com. That's 2024AIStock.com, paid for by Chaikin Analytics. David, I would love to think that the American Jewish community is going to recognize both the place of really virulent anti-Semitism on the left in America, really have a better understanding of it now after October 7th, and see that the Democrat Party both gives that some degree of safe harbor and can't be trusted when the going gets a little tough politically to support Israel. That may have an effect, but I worry that other issues or perhaps just the propaganda machinery will cloud things. What do you make of this?
Well, I think there's a few points to understand in terms of the Jewish vote. I mean, the first one is, like all populations, the Jewish population is not monolithic. You know, there are different segments to the community. The divide is mostly more Orthodox versus secular, I guess, in the same way as you have in, you know, the wider electorate. You know, typically more religious people tend to vote more conservative, and the more secular folks tend to vote more liberal. So the Jewish community is divided in a similar way. And, you know, demographically, what's interesting for people to understand is that these two segments of the Jewish community are headed in opposite directions. The liberal wing of the Jewish community is in decline, significantly in decline, and the more Orthodox wing of the Jewish community is one of the fastest growing Jewish populations, in the United States. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, voting shifts in terms of demographic populations typically take generations. You know, you have, and you know, that's certainly the case of the Jewish community as an immigrant community. Initially, as an immigrant community, the Democratic Party was always seen as the more friendly to immigrants, and I think that's kind of the assumption for Latinos and, you know, other minority groups, that the Democratic Party is more friendly. But, you know, like with the Italians and other and Irish and other immigrant groups, as they become more entrenched and as they become more comfortable in the country and start to think about other things like, you know, it's not just about food stamps, it's about private property, and wealth grows and their success grows. You know, that's when you see voting patterns start to evolve. So I think in that sense, when people think about the Jewish vote or other population segments and how they vote, you know, you want to think about it not from election to election, but from generation to generation in terms of how these patterns evolve. Having said that, I would say that I think there's a significant misread in the Democratic Party over where the Jewish population is, where the Jewish public is. You know, certainly the events of October 7th and their aftermath have left a lot of folks in the Jewish community feeling very unsettled. And you're seeing folks that typically would be on the more liberal side expressing a lot of concern. In fact, I don't know if you saw this. It was kind of circulating on the web the other day on Twitter. But there's a rabbi called Amiel Hirsch, who's a rabbi at a very famous liberal synagogue in New York, the Stephen Weiss Synagogue. He gave a lecture or a sermon on Saturday, you know, at the Shabbat service, and he said to the Democrats, he said, "Do not take American Jews for granted. Be careful." These are his words. "The results of the upcoming elections do not only depend on Michigan." And there are quite a few swing states where the Jewish population is much larger than the margin of victory that Joe Biden had last time. And those include Pennsylvania, where the Jewish population outweighs the Muslim population by about 4-1. That's 19 electoral points. Michigan is only 10 electoral points. Obviously, Florida, I don't know if you still consider it a swing state, but the Jewish vote there is very significant. Arizona, you've got about 100,000 Jews. Ohio, about 100,000 Jews. Georgia, about 100,000 Jews. You know, so North Carolina, I don't think it's that many, but, you know, it's a significant population. So, you know, they can be a very significant factor in this election, and I think the Democrats are misreading it. Misreading kind of where the Jewish community is at. But one other point that I think is worth making is the role of RFK might have on this point. You know, the lowest percentage of the Jewish vote that any Democratic candidate received in the last 100 years was the 1980 election where Jimmy Carter ran against Ronald Reagan. Carter was perceived as being quite unfriendly towards Israel. He received only 45% of the Jewish vote. Reagan received 39% of the Jewish vote. But what a lot of people don't remember was that it was actually a third-party candidate called John Anderson who was running at the time, and he received 15% of the national vote. So you may have a similar scenario here where folks that are really unhappy with Joe Biden but aren't quite ready to pull the trigger for Trump are going to head in the direction of RFK. And I actually interviewed him about it last week. We had an exclusive story about it for The Sun. And he, you know, he maintained that this wasn't an electoral advantage, a political advantage. He was taking the position that's supportive of Israel on principle. But I think, you know, I don't know how closely he's looked at the Jewish vote. And obviously, you know, there's a lot that you discover once people get into the voting booths. I think there is a decent chance that Biden will be surprised at how low his support in the Jewish community is. And I don't know how much is going to go for Donald Trump, if it's going to be more than the typical 30%, maybe slightly more. But I wouldn't be surprised if you have a nice chunk of the Jewish vote that actually goes for RFK.
Let's certainly hope so. Before we let you go, David, first off, everyone should go check out and read and subscribe to the New York Sun. They're doing great work over there. David has entirely revived that august and storied publication. Are you a coffee drinker, David?
I am, yes.
I'll have to send you some Crockett coffee, my friend. This is a brand that Clay Travis, my co-host, and I have founded in the spirit of Davy Crockett, frontier, adventurism, America, the frontier spirit, Davy Crockett, CrockettCoffee.com. I'm going to send you some up in New York so you can try it. Hopefully you will find it delicious.
America's drug. Coffee is America's drug.
Absolutely. The one thing that I need every day is coffee. I tell you, that's why Clay and I are talking about what should we do? Well, we definitely need coffee because we need it. So CrockettCoffee.com will send some up to David. I hope you at home listening will subscribe. Do at least, if you would, a $60 order. Then you get free shipping, which makes it very cost effective. Go to CrockettCoffee.com. David, always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Likewise. Take care, bud.
Since 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been committed to improving the lives of America's veterans, first responders, and their families. For over 20 years, the foundation has helped America keep its solemn promise to never forget. Tunnel to Towers provides mortgage-free homes to Gold Star families and the families of fallen first responders with young children, and builds specially adapted smart homes for catastrophically injured veterans, as well as work to eradicate veteran homelessness. David Marshall served in the Army during World War II and fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He's never forgotten the sacrifices of his comrades in arms, nor the efforts of first responders on 9/11 and in the days and months that followed. He is a loyal and proud foundation donor. Tunnel to Towers is committed to supporting veterans, first responders, and their families, and so many of them need your help. Join the foundation on its mission to do good and never forget. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at t2t.org. That's t2t.org.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.